Welcome to this podcast for Classical 91.5. I'm Julia Figueres. This week, your Rochester Philharmonic Orchestra offers up a Brahms sandwich, two from the master, with Chopin in the middle. Here to talk about that menu is Ward Stair, the RPO music director. Welcome back, Ward.
Hi, Julia. Nice to see you.
Great to have you back always. And in our studios for the very first time, very happy to introduce you to pianist Ingrid Fleeter. Welcome.
Hello. Thank you.
So, let's start off with the Brahms, shall we? The first piece is actually, it's something that Brahms wrote, but Bright Sheng decided to do something else with it. So tell us a little bit about what this is.
Well, it's the Intermezzo, Opus 118, number 2. It's from the six pieces that Brahms wrote really at the end of his life. I mean, I think it was the second to last work that was published before his death, if I'm not mistaken. And it's charming, it's gorgeous, it's beautiful, it's sort of like a lullaby or a love letter maybe to Clara Schumann, or you know, whoever you want to think. Had to have been her, actually. But it's a gorgeous piece. It's a piece that I've known for a long time, just you know, in the piano version. And then I became aware recently that there was this great orchestration done of it by Bright Sheng, and I took a look at it and thought this would be the perfect, you know, addition to this program, because we have the large scale, you know, mammoth symphony on the second half, and this, you know, wonderful Chopin in between. And so this sort of is homage, you know, pays homage to the piano element of Brahms, which was a huge part of his life. And, you know, also it's something new for our audiences, which I try to do on every program this year. So I thought it was a nice fit, and it's just it's a gorgeous piece.
Does it do anything to it outside of obviously orchestrating it? Anything unusual happen?
No, he didn't add any bars or anything like that. It's perfectly represented as the piano version is. But the choices that he made orchestrating it, I think, were very good. I mean, you have nice contrast. It's an interesting concept, because if, you know, the performances that I've heard of the piano version, which are my favorite, are the ones where the pianist is extremely creative in the way they voice and the way they pace and the way, I mean, you have to with a piece like that. And so, you know, it makes sense actually to say, hey, let's orchestrate this and use the color palette available in full orchestra.
Hey, we've got a pianist right here. We can ask her.
We do. She's nodding her head. Yeah.
No, I think that it's very an interesting point, because sometimes we try to think when we play some piano music, we try to think Beethoven or Brahms especially, what would the orchestration be? Mm-hmm. So in this case, we have it offered and we can get an inspiration from it. So it's interesting. I will listen with big curiosity to see what choices of instruments he did for certain melodies or certain colors that I know very well, that I might be dreaming to create. But for the piano, you have to use so much imagination to create and emulate what an orchestra can do.
Right.
So interesting experience for me too.
Do you play a lot of Brahms, Ingrid?
Well, actually, that's a very delicate question, and good that you ask, because it's a love that accompanied me in different ways. When I was a child, more like an admiration, a faraway admiration. And now I'm getting much more nearer to this universe, because he needs a different approach to the piano that I'm normally used to do. So I grew up with Chopin, Beethoven, even with Schubert, Schumann. It's more immediate reaction through the piano as a pianist playing these composers. But with Brahms, you need to explore other sides of also from your physical point of view. So you have to develop this big sound, this big belly that he had. No, the bear and the belly.
Sit back in a chair.
Yeah. Exactly. So I'm exploring that, and I haven't felt ready to play his music in public. I worked a lot on the small pieces and even some the Sonata number 1 I love very much especially. And I played a lot of chamber music by him in public, but alone pieces I haven't been daring enough, so I might be in the future.
And that's very interesting, because I know of a wonderful pianist who likes and loves to play these big Brahms piano things, but it was for a longest time uncomfortable with your composer Chopin, and particularly the mazurkas. He said getting the internal logic and rhythm was almost possible for you.
I know, I understand. Brendel used to say that if you play well Chopin, it will be almost impossible to play well Schubert or Brahms. Well, he's a little bit extremist, but I understand why he says that, because it's a complete different sound universe mm-hmm. that you have to create with these composers.
So the let's talk about the other Brahms and then go back to the Chopin for a moment, because the other thing on the program is that symphony.
The other thing, yeah.
That other Brahms thing, that
right.
little
That
thing.
First symphony. Well, where should we start? It's
20 years?
It's epic. Yeah, over 20 years. I mean, he struggled with the creation of this symphony mightily, and I think what we have at the end of this epic journey that he went on is just a true monument in classical music. I mean, the thing that I think was probably the most responsible for it, in addition to his own personality traits, which, you know, he was very mindful of where, you know, he fit in history. He was also mindful of his legacy. He was very fastidious. He, you know, he was a perfectionist. Brahms burned more music than he let go out of his studio. I think I've told you the story before, but it's one of my favorites. He told his housekeeper that his wastebasket was the most important piece of furniture in his apartment because he was constantly, you know, he wrote more vocal music than anything else in his life. Most people don't know that, but he destroyed most of it because he didn't think it was worthy for the public. And, you know, he came at a time in history where, you know, Beethoven was the giant, and he wrote openly about how, you know, Beethoven's shadow was looming, his footsteps, you know,
following
were so
those
big.
Giant and, footsteps.
Right. And of course, another story I like to tell often is that, you know, if you look in, there's some photos or some, drawings you can find of, you know, the way Brahms had his studio set up. And it's funny because he had this complex about Beethoven, yet he didn't help himself because he had a huge bust of Beethoven mounted on his wall over his piano in his apartment in London. So, not London, excuse me, in Vienna. But it was very much on his mind, and it was actually on everybody's mind, because after Beethoven 9, you know, people, critics and public alike, were thinking, well, there's nowhere else to go in the symphony. What are we going to do? And so it's and Brahms really took his time, because he understood the importance of what this would mean as a statement, you know, his first symphony. And people had been trying to get him to write a symphony for years. I mean, Robert Schumann wanted him to write a symphony. Joachim wanted him to write a symphony. All of his closest friends were saying, write this symphony. And he said, I'm not ready yet. I mean, his first piano concerto, we talked about that a couple weeks ago, was originally conceived as a symphony, and it didn't end up becoming one. Mm-hmm. And so we have the sketches, and the thought process began, you know, over 20 years. Brahms himself said it took him over 20 years to come up with this piece. And it's astounding. And also, it's an interesting note. I was talking to a couple musicians in the orchestra and telling them that he cut a lot out of the symphony after its first performance, because it was performed, I think it was 77, I think, was the premiere, and 78 it was published, or maybe 76-7. Anyway, there was a year time that elapsed between the first performances and the publication of it, and he actually made the second movement shorter, believe it or not, and he made a couple little additions, so he was tinkering with it right up to the end. And then, you know, there are a lot of parallels that are often drawn with Beethoven himself. You know, one of the themes in the first movement, you know, the three short notes followed by the long is supposed to be a reference to Beethoven 5, you know, and the fate
is
motive.
Is it really?
I don't know. I think that's maybe a little bit of a stretch. And, you know, when people said that, it would annoy Brahms. And the closer links, I think, exist in the last movement with
that theme.
Yeah, they call it the big tune or the big theme, which is, you know, similar to the Ode to Joy. And also, actually, the form, because the way the symphony is, the third movement kind of goes into the fourth movement, is really great if you do it. Sometimes, you know, on recordings, you lose the effect if you just listen to it on a CD player, because there's this extra time added. But in live performance, when you finish the third movement, you should go quasi attacca into the fourth. And it's very much like Beethoven 5 and how mm-hmm. he goes from the third movement to the finale. And so that's a very definite connection. The other thing is, for many, many, many years, The symphony had no introduction. The introduction we all know now, this monumental sound that just comes out and bowls you over.
Thing.
That was the last thing that he wrote. He had completed the whole symphony, and he decided he needed to tack on an introduction. So it started at the Allegro, which is a very clear allusion to Beethoven 3, where there's really no big introduction. He jumps right in. You know, and most people don't know that either. It's very interesting. And then when you go back, another thing that's worth noting is he was very, very particular about his dynamics and the colors and textures that he wanted throughout the symphony. But the opening, it's this big, you know, it's like monolithic. I mean, it's just this epic sound wall of sound that kind of comes at you. But he only marks it forte. And he marks it un poco sostenuto, so it shouldn't be too slow. You know, it's not fast, but it you know, it's got a flow to it. It's a steady, you know, development through these phrases, and it's only forte. He saves fortissimo for later. So I think, you know, it's partly psychological. This is the last part that he wrote, right, for the symphony. So rather than this huge extroverted, like, you know, here I am, you know, this is my first symphony after 21 years, I think there has to be an element of mystery and control in the opening, because it's more about confidence. You know, he's worked on this for 21 years, and yes, here, I am now going to present you with this first symphony.
And what is going to happen? That question, you've waited a really long time.
Right.
And now something's about to happen, and I bet you can't guess what.
Yeah, and think about the anticipation that everyone had with this. And then when he opens in such a serious manner, it's just, whoa. And he gets this sound. I mean, some people I've heard say that, you know, he wasn't the most imaginative orchestrator. Well, I don't think that's true, actually. His orchestration is really amazing because of the way he voices things, you know, and talking about the voicing, like in the piano earlier, it's the same thing, the way you voice in the orchestra, his emphasis on certain colors and instruments in the middle registers, and how he doubles certain things in the bass to give it a little bit of weight, and the way he divides up the violins and the voicing, and it creates this wonderful pyramid of sound that sounds very, I mean, it's Brahms. It's unmistakable.
Mm-hmm.
And then from there, you know, the first movement is very long. I don't take the repeat. Very few people do. It's kind of an odd moment. If you do take the repeat, it's a little bit jarring. But he also was innovative with the symphony. You know, people said at the time, you know, there's this big, there are two schools. There was, you know, the Liszt, Wagner schools of, you know, going way, you know, out there with program music and, you know, atonality and things like that, and people would criticize Brahms for being too conservative and old-fashioned. But I think that's a mistake as well, because if you look at what he does with the form of the first symphony, he modifies, you know, the sonata allegro form in very subtle ways, but he starts developing themes earlier than Beethoven or Haydn would or Mozart, and the way that he introduces new characters and new spins on things, music that we've already heard, is quite unique, and I think just brilliant, absolutely brilliant. And another thing, you know, psychologically, this really, you have to have a concept about the piece when you perform it, because it's such a big work, and you have to really think about the architecture and how the story unfolds. And one interesting thing that I think is worth mentioning is, if you look at each movement, they kind of end in a hesitant, maybe, I mean, they end on the softer side with the intensity and with the sound, and then he gets finally to the fourth movement, and the outer movements are so monumental that the inner movements are really more like intermezzos. You know, they have to be, because you need a break. It would be devastating, and you would not be able to handle the emotion if the inner movements were as intense as the outer movements. And he doesn't give us an adagio or a really slow movement. The second movement is just marked andante. You know, and again, it's just a beautiful song, but with a lot of great detail. And again, it sort of winds down, and it ends very quietly. And you know, it's not a bold statement with a definite, you know, okay, that was my second movement. Wasn't that great? You know, third movement, the same. It ends, you know, rather ambiguously, and it's like, oh, okay, this was interesting. Where are we going now? And then the way we go into the fourth movement, and then when the fourth movement starts, he refuses to let it start. That introduction is just amazing to the fourth movement, with the pizzicati and the strings, and how there's an accelerando. It sort of ramps up like it's going to get going, and then he grinds everything to a screeching halt again and starts this very, very slow build. And then again, things are ramped up in the strings. And then, you know, we get sort of this tempest, this storm which builds. And it it's unclear what he's, you know, what are you trying to do? Where are you going? What are you saying? And it's, it's part of, I think, the epic struggle that he went through in creating the whole piece. And it's also, you know, he was also very shy, even though, you know, we think of him now, I guess, as this very confident, you know, stoic, you know, I was Brahms, I'm in the pantheon of, you know, composers and all this. But he was very insecure, he was very shy, and I think that's part of the form in the fourth movement. And if you think of it that way, it makes the beginning of the body of the fourth movement even more compelling.
It also echoes the fourth movement of Beethoven's ninth.
Again, yes, another parallel.
Which gets a theme started and throws it away.
Right.
And does it again and
right.
throws it away until finally this theme here.
Finally you get it. And, you know, in one of my favorite quotes about the first symphony from Brahms is, you know, people were belaboring the parallel with, you know, the fifth and the ninth symphony, especially the ninth symphony, and he said, oh, any ass can see that. You know, it really annoyed him that people would just fixate on those things. And then there's another line of thinking which I kind of like, even though, you know, I'm a huge Beethoven fan, but that Brahms was sort of saying, yes, this is my response to the ninth symphony, but I'm reclaiming the symphonic form for the orchestra alone, because he writes this big choral melody, which is, you know, very much like the Ode to Joy, but he's making it work and making it sing and making it beautiful without employing voices, Beethoven did.
Yeah, it's kind of like the Ode to Joy sideways.
Well, in a way, yeah. I mean, it's very interesting. But then again, look at the way he develops that theme once we get to it. But leading up to that, see, after this interesting opening to the introduction, then we get this, you know, the Alphorn theme, which you hear played in the horns, and it's one of these amazing moments where things, the character shifts, and then all of a sudden you hear, it was a shepherd, an Alphorn, and he wrote in a postcard, he actually wrote the theme down to Clara when he was talking about it, and he lifted it directly from something that he actually experienced, a shepherd in the distance on the hillside, playing this wonderful searching theme. And I think searching is the most important character of it, because he was searching for 21 years for his first symphony. And you hear that emotion, you know, like always looking for something. What? And I haven't found it yet. Even though we're, you know, 30 plus minutes into this work, I haven't found it yet. And it just tugs at your heartstrings. And then the flute plays the same melody again. And the orchestra is very atmospheric, very gentle, actually. It's a very pensive moment. And then all of a sudden, he introduces this chorale theme when the trombones join, which is the first time really that they play in the entire symphony, and I think of it as, you know, this big landscape, and as I said, searching, and then all of a sudden you spot what your goal, what you want to achieve, what you want to reach, what you want to have, but it's not there yet. Everything is still very far off in the distance. The trombones come in very softly. They play with the bassoons. And the horns join at the very end, and it's a very beautiful A major moment. And then, only then, are we ready for the big theme. And it starts, it's so warm, it's so, the humanity of it, the beauty of it is just astounding. And it's just the strings. It's a simple iteration of it in the strings.
And it catches me by surprise
every
single
time. Every time, yeah.
You know it's coming. You love this very much, mm-hmm. and then all of a sudden, it's sitting in your lap and giving you a big smooch.
Oh, it's unbelievable. And, you know, and if you think about all these things that go into the development to lead you up to that point, I mean, anyone who says that Brahms was not a great dramatist is crazy, because there's so much drama, so much anticipation, so much buildup to this moment. And then, as only a true master could, he doesn't just, you know, give it away. It's a very subtle thing. It's a very beautiful moment. And then the chorale, after it's played by the strings, it's played again by the woodwinds, and goes through in a very, it just flows, and then it just gets ratcheted up ever so slightly. And, you know, he writes animato, just a little bit faster, a little bit faster. It's almost like you can sense the arrival at that goal that we were searching for, and it's coming, and the joy of it, and the exuberance and the excitement at reaching it. But he still doesn't let us get there right away. He makes us wait for it. And there's this great buildup. And another thing that I love about the symphony, architecturally speaking, is that there are these moments. There are a couple in the first movement, and there are a couple in the last movement. And the final one is the most dramatic. And there are these moments where he takes the orchestra and he just lets it wind down so slowly, you know, in tempo and orchestration and dynamic in every way, until it almost comes to a halt, although it never does, really. And then it gradually starts ramping up again. And I think, you know, a good image is like a big steam engine or locomotive, you know, that just, it takes a little bit of time to get going. And then as it starts to chug and churn, it starts to build up this tremendous momentum. And then by the time it's just about up to speed, there's really no stopping it. I mean, it can level everything in its way, and it just takes you forward, you know, with no questions asked. And so that happens a couple times, and the final time that it happens in the symphony is the buildup to that A major chorale that the trombones first introduced, but then the entire orchestra plays it fortissimo, and it's one of the most just triumphant and thrilling moments in all the repertoire.
The RPO copy says online it gave a mighty roar that both invoked the past and heralded the future.
Yes.
Well, we've talked about the past, but very briefly, heralded the future in what way?
Oh, boy. I think, you know, to say there's more work to be done in the symphonic form. You know, Beethoven didn't exhaust everything, you know. And also with the form itself, you know, he was saying, let's keep exploring, let's keep imagining. I can do it, so should you. And I think even though this is his first symphony, it feels in a way like his last symphony because it's so monumental. But each one of his symphonies are extraordinary, and each one of them have very, very different character. Very different. I mean, no two Brahms symphonies are at all alike. I mean, the second one is very sunny, very light. The third one is kind of actually the most challenging, I think, to interpret, but it's a beautiful work.
Huge, open, quiet ending.
Yeah, yeah. And the fourth one is a little bit more, thoughtful and sort of final. I mean, it's definitely a mature work in a lot of ways. Autumnal is a good, yes. But this first one just sort of stands on its own as a monument. I mean, it really is. It's one of my favorites. I mean, I always say, whenever I conduct a Brahms symphony, I say, this is my favorite one, because, you know, that particular week, it is my favorite one. But I do love the first. It's really fantastic.
Now, in between these two Brahms pieces is the Chopin Piano Concerto number 1. And we are fortunate. Number 2?
You make me freeze.
Oh,
1 second. Because
her eyes just got really big.
Yeah,
what?
Her eyes got
huge. We rehearsed 2 today, Ingrid, but tomorrow we're going to go
one.
Okay.
The real one is tomorrow. Because it happened once in the past.
Oh, really?
That some pianist was ready to play the first one, and the orchestra played, and I said, well, I prepared the other one. And then possibly you have to be ready to... catch it back, you know?
Thank goodness we caught that early. But we are very fortunate to have probably the preeminent performer of Chopin in the house with us, and that's Ingrid Fleeter.
That's a very really kind compliment. Thank you.
It's not kind, it's fact. And that's just the way that is. You won the 2006 Gilmore Award.
Yes.
And this award is very different in that there's no competition. So... the process to win the Gilmore is really interesting. Can you explain it?
Yeah, it was actually a big surprise for me too, because I have never really heard about the possibility to win this award. So I knew that wonderful pianists like Ansnes or Andrzejewski won some award, that I didn't know what it was really and what represented. I was informed about that. And actually a week before the announcement, the private announcement, I called my mom and I told her, you know, I read that there is this amazing award that nobody knows how it works. How do you win it? How do you apply? And then I sent her the link, and she was, and we were chatting about this. I said, oh, interesting. What a nice initiative, because you're judged in your natural habitat. very good, but okay, obviously there is no way to apply. That's it. Because I think that's the best way to be judged, if you have to be judged somehow in music. Otherwise, when you play in front of an audience, in front of a jury, then you have to show something or convince them of what you're capable to do or not. So there is an artificial component in your playing, for sure, if you think that way. So the fact that it's an award, okay, so I thought it was a very interesting idea, and I just let it go. A week later, I was in Atlanta playing a recital for the Chopin Society, and a man from the Gilmore Festival, Dan Gustin, calls me and says that he's coming to Atlanta because he wants to propose me a concert in the festival, which I said, great, very nice, very good. I was in that recital. He came backstage before I go on stage. I was very angry. Say, oh, the piano is not good. Well, how am I going to do this? He said, don't worry. After this, you will start playing in much better instruments. I promise you. Why is he saying such thing to me? How can he promise such thing? Okay. So after the concert, we go for dinner. And I was eating my salad, and his very informal meeting. And I was expecting him finally to tell me, wait, you're invited to play in the festival, because I thought that was the reason. We are almost finishing the dinner. Nothing happens. And then he says, okay, you know that we give awards every 4 years. And this and this other pianist has won this. And okay, you're the next winner. I say, of what exactly? Excuse me. Okay, so from then on, all the rest has happened.
they catch performers in various halls, in various venues, sometimes in recital, sometimes in chamber, sometimes as an orchestral performer, yes. And you don't know.
Exactly. So then I got
familiar. Somebody nominated you.
Yes.
Do you know who?
Yes.
You too?
Yes, because it's a long story. It's you know, life somehow connects you to certain realities that you cannot imagine a priori that they are going to happen. So this is absolutely one of the cases, because this woman was one of the presenters of the Washington Performing Arts Society. She invited me maybe 4 or 5 years before the Gilmore to play for their society in Washington, Annadel Rich. So she invited me with another colleague of hers, Franz Grasch, and they both invited me to play because Leon Fleischer advised them to do so. So they were asking advice of Leon Fleischer if I was invitable or not, and he said yes, because I studied with him in Como Academy. So it goes back in time a lot. So, and then finally, okay, so I came, I played for them. I had a beautiful article written by Tim Page, which I still have, because I was very thankful to him. He gave me a big hand in that, in the Washington Post. Okay, and then the time flew with no many surprises in this side of the globe in the United States. I did, in the meantime, a tour with the Warsaw Philharmonic after the Chopin competition. We played 17 times in 18 days, the Chopin Concerto No. 1. So I got in touch with people here and there. I don't know who listened to me, who not. But obviously there was some movement, some name that sounded familiar to the people from Gilmore. And there was a recording as well that I made, surprising. They did it without me knowing very well. I was even sick that day that they recorded this CD in the Amsterdam Concertgebouw. Actually, that was the CD that finally made them decide that they were going to follow me. So it's a big combination of factors, but definitely the nomination of this Annadel Rich made a big difference, because Dan Gustin called Annadel and asked her, who would you recommend us? You have to give one name, and she gave mine. So they started following me, as maybe 20 or 30 other pianists, and they narrowed down, and finally the last year they started following only four, And then only two, and then...
I think it would be like the coolest job in the world.
Yes,
to work for Gilmore and just follow pianists around watching them. No, she fell off the piano. Can't use her.
Yeah, I can't use her.
Really?
Exactly.
What a fantastic...
But the best thing is that you don't know. So if they don't like you, that's perfect. They don't choose you, but you never really know. That it's not a... Yeah.
Okay. So a lot of pianists who win the Gilmore buy pianos. Now I know that Kirill Gerstein did not, because he owns like four.
I know.
So he didn't have to do that. Did you buy a piano?
I did.
You did.
Yeah, I did.
You followed the tradition of purchasing the piano. So you know it's so appropriate that you should win that. And you also won in the Chopin competition, right? You won silver or something. So it's so appropriate that you're here, Ingrid, to play your thing, which is Chopin 2. So actually, it's probably Chopin's first piano concerto.
Probably, yes. It was written more or less in the same period. So he was only 18 years old.
18 years old.
And can you imagine the maturity of his feelings, of how connected he was to what he felt? This is something that surprised me, because it's only a boy. I know that Mendelssohn was also premature, and Mozart was as well. Chopin speaks with such a personal voice already in that music that it's astonishing what he can do. It seems that he understands about love, about his position in the world, his voice, his way of saying things, and totally at ease, totally in a natural way. He's very much in touch with nature.
So when did your love affair with Chopin begin?
Since I have memories, actually, musical memories, because at home there was always Rubinstein recordings sounding everywhere, in the kitchen, in the car, living room. My parents are big fans of Rubinstein and Chopin music, and my father used to play piano a little bit, and he used to play Chopin, of course, and I heard this music all my life, so it was like drinking water, and I grew up with this a lot. And then I was lucky because I had a teacher who put me into that stream quite soon. She understood the importance of studying Chopin music, not just because of moving the fingers and because he pushes you to work your technique a lot, but that was not the approach. The approach was that thanks to Chopin you can discover the beauty of playing the piano, which is a different thing. It's not how you get faster and strong fingers. That's, of course, part of the education. But how you enjoy searching for the colors in the piano, how to fight against the nature of this instrument, which is a percussive instrument and not a singing one. And in Chopin, if you don't learn how to sing, you cannot play. He said that himself. So you have to defeat that nature and imagine that you're a singer.
Now, a lot of Chopin sounds absolutely easy. When you hear somebody play Chopin, it sounds like that's a walk in the park. I could do that. But that's not true.
Exactly. Well, that's the end of the process of making it possible. And Chopin himself, imagine the situation that he sounds so natural when he listened to his music. But actually, when he composed, he was in such a pain, internal pain, that he could not, some days, could not put his face up because he was crying and destroying the papers that he wrote, and because he improvised. So he sat down at the piano and everything came naturally. And then he tried to put that in writing. Mm-hmm. And it was so frustrating. That's written in the book of George Sand. She says, poor little man. She says, he's so talented, but so tortured. Mm. Why art should be so torturing? Okay.
I think he was tortured because he was dating George Sand. I'm just saying.
I agree.
That didn't help him at all.
No, I agree with you. She was an inspiration, but any person would have been, because he was inspired by nature and not by her especially, I think.
So is it difficult for you who work with this man who's by and large a miniaturist, but with the most complex miniatures ever inside of each of his pieces, to move to Beethoven, to move to Brahms? Are these very different for you to play on the piano?
Well, as a fact, I grew up also playing a lot of Beethoven as well. And that's my other hero. I must say that Beethoven has saved me from different situations in life, actually, personally. Knowing that I have Beethoven in my life had made my life better and my relationship with music. So I must say that he is a guru.
He's your guru.
He is my guru, I must say. Chopin, obviously, is my biggest love, let's say, because I have a very personal relationship with Chopin. But with Beethoven, there's no question of choice. My heart is very big, so I have space for all of them together. But especially Beethoven is my light, somehow.
How old were you when you started playing, Ingrid?
Very old, 9 years old. Everyone starts at two or three. They gave concerts already in Carnegie Hall at 3 years. No, my first concert was at 10 and a half or almost 11. And my first orchestra concert was Beethoven 3 and in Teatro Colón, and I was 16, actually, 16.
Wow, so you really did not do that hothouse flower little, you know, you were a kid. You got out to play in the snow before you actually cracked down on the practicing.
Absolutely, yes, and I'm very glad I did. Actually, I didn't have any snow in Argentina, but the first time I got to know the snow, it was in Germany when I went for the first time to study there. But yeah, I had time to be a child, and I think it's important.
Now let's talk about this, the Piano Concerto Number 2, because, and this is where you come in. There are people who say his orchestration not so good. And this is kind of a thing with the Chopin, the two piano concertos. So is it good? Is it mundane, his orchestration?
Well, I mean, I think you're looking at it in the wrong way if you're thinking only about that, because it's not what he set out to do. He wasn't trying to be a great orchestrator.
Exactly.
What he's doing in these pieces is providing a wonderful setting for the pianist. And mm-hmm. So our job is not to really add a lot of coloring. I mean, there are moments where, you know, we add to the texture in a very nice way, actually. But most of it is shading and coloring and reinforcing and supporting what the pianist does, and that's the critical thing. We have to listen. It's very, I mean, it's like the definition of chamber music. I mean, you listen, you play together, and I love that process. It's, you know, it's challenging for an orchestra to play these concertos well.
For a conductor
and,
to
yeah.
have the capacity of listening the way you do. Really,
well,
I'm not saying this because
you.
We are here and I want everyone to know, but it's true. It's true. The feeling of freedom that Ward gives me, it's very special, and that's one of the main subjects here.
Well, it's, you know, it's a team effort for all of us, and it's a great challenge, but that's one of the reasons why I wanted Ingrid here for this program, because I've been a fan of her playing. You know, we've never met or worked together. This is the first mm-hmm. time. But, you know, I heard your recordings of the Chopin and everything, and I think I saw you live somewhere. I was trying to remember where that was, but she is so free, and I mean, everything she just said about her relationship with it all makes sense with Chopin, and so my goal is just to allow her to be completely unfettered, and the orchestra has a lot of responsibility in that too, because mm-hmm. they have to listen. I mean,
exactly.
A conductor cannot conduct rubato very well in any situation, but especially with a piece like Chopin. What I have to do is my role is really being out of the way as much as possible, keeping things quiet so that we're sensitive enough that we can hear what Ingrid's doing, and then if we can all try to just fit her like a glove, then it's working.
Mm-hmm. And breathe together.
And breathe together,
and
yes.
Breathe, yeah.
Yes.
And is it interesting, Chopin's orchestral writing is interesting because he'll be very big and very bold
mm-hmm.
and then just step back.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Almost completely to almost nothing, so that the pianist is right there on top of everything before he brings that orchestra back.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's very clear who the star is.
But you said something very nice about the coloring, because it adds a very important component. If you take it away and you play just the piano part, it's clearly missing mm-hmm. all that section. And that helps the piano fly.
Yeah.
The first movement is very big, and it's, again, the longest part of the concerto lies in that very big, huge opening. Do you want to talk about that at all?
Well, it builds, but it actually opens rather simply. You know, da-da-da, just it says maestoso, and then it's just this gentle line which sort of begins first violins, and then it reaches, you know, a climax after not too much time has passed. Mm-hmm. But no, it's just about setting the stage mm-hmm. for the pianist, and you know, it's sort of the curtains coming up, and here we go, and it's great.
Someone described the second movement as a work of undescribable beauty.
Mm. Mm-hmm. I would agree with that.
It is.
If it's done well.
Which it will be. Which it will be. When you play something like the second movement of Chopin's Piano Concerto No. 2, to me, as the person who's generally sitting out in the audience and starting to cry, how do you... go through that.
It's a big responsibility. If you don't cry tomorrow, it's a bad sign then. You let me know.
I will. I'll
keep okay. Set the bar high.
excuse me, you asked me a question?
So when you are playing a piece of music that has a really intense emotional piece, mm-hmm. do you have to separate yourself
uh-huh.
out?
Good point. I think we are continuously divided in our mind as performers. So you have to give completely yourself, but still be at the service of the music and still be in charge of what's happening, so in control of your own emotions, but also let go and also completely abandoned. So you have to find the balance in all this and make the music as it was part of you, as it was composed by you in a way. I think Leonard Bernstein said something that I always get very much related to, which is the fact that the interpreter has to become somehow the composer, even if it sounds pretentious, which is not at all. It's simply the way that it speaks in the first person. You're not reproducing something that you think is what the composer felt, that you feel in the same way. So in a way, you're an actor. So you enter the character, and you're not yourself anymore. And it's a great opportunity to be someone else, even better, much better than what we are. So when you play Chopin, I feel that I become a much better person than what I am. I am not the one who is drinking this bottle of water and having a coffee later. No, or shopping even. I'm much better. You become much better. It's an opportunity to explore who you can be. So, of course, you give everything, but at the same point, you're not yourself anymore.
When you get to that third movement, which is sprightly and a nice way to do it, there's a really interesting thing that he does with the bows and the
violins.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Where they bounce the wooden part on the string, which is very... I mean, that's a great example. You say the orchestration is dull. It's not dull. There's a mm-hmm. lot of really wonderful mm-hmm. moments
no,
there.
I didn't say it was and dull. I said people have said
okay, well, yes, that's true. But no, that's a great moment. And also in that passage, it's very free, the rubato
yes.
and the back and forth with the pianist. I mean, it's very...
A popular dance, a folkloric
yeah,
dance.
Yeah, I mean, it's a delightful movement, and it's so vibrant, and it's so full of personality.
Yes,
and
it has to sound easy, as you
yeah,
said before.
Right.
Oh, it sounds easy. You can't imagine how difficult it is. But the problem is that it doesn't sound difficult like Rachmaninoff or Prokofiev. People are obviously seeing the difficulty of the pianist playing, and
right.
then you get the satisfaction of the big applause. But then in Chopin, people appreciate the beauty, and they feel very much attracted to it. But they do. It's good. I don't pretend that they see the difficulty because otherwise I'm doing something is not right. So
it's funny you should say that because I know of a pianist who said that Rachmaninoff sounds so difficult, but it's really much easier on him than Chopin
or Mozart,
which sounds so simple and is so much more difficult. He said he really.
I have to agree to that.
Mm-hmm. You know, I guess you really look like you're kicking out the jams when you're playing Rachmaninoff, but
also for the fact that Chopin, the romanticism of Chopin is not so obvious. It's not Byronic, like Byron, that you just show your blood going out from like strips. No, you have to be somehow also balanced in a way that he's a classical being, a very elegant, reserved man in a way. So he's not explosive, and his romanticism somehow shows that part of his personality. So walking the line between classical and romantic, it's hard. It's hard because you cannot be detached, because otherwise it's cold. Music alone doesn't sound, because people think, oh, Chopin is so beautifully written and the melodies are so nice. You can do nothing and it will sound good. Probably yes, probably it's true. But you will feel that there's something missing. It has to be a story underneath, personal story. And so that line is difficult to achieve, the balance between classical and romantic.
You're not in your head, Ward.
Hmm?
You're not in your head.
Oh, yeah. No, I agree completely. And I was actually thinking, not to go back, but about the Brahms, too, and how that, because he was sort of right in the romantic, you know, era, but he was a classicist. Was he a romantic? Was he this? Was he that? Well, the answer is he was a little bit of everything.
Exactly.
But you, one thing that just popped into my mind as Ingrid was speaking there was that, you know, the external effects, you know, that you get in Berlioz or even in Beethoven, actually, to a degree, because he puts some, you know, fireworks in a lot of his pieces intentionally, and it's good. I love Beethoven. He's also my guru in a lot of ways. But Brahms is not flashy like that. Everything in Brahms comes from inside, and it's much more organic. It's much more personal, even though it's large scale. It's different, and it's not artificial, and it's not insincere. I think sincerity is a very important part of it.
And it's very interesting that I always get that same feeling about Dvorak, and of course the relationship
Brahms
between
and Dvorak, and
that this tied in as well. Mm-hmm. So when all is said and done, you're going to become a professor, yes, in Imola.
I teach now already.
You teach now?
Yes,
so
since a year, and it's amazing because I learn a lot. When you teach, you learn.
Mm-hmm.
It's incredible, but true.
How many students do you have?
I have 12.
And how many of them have to play Chopin?
All of them. I will torture them.
Before you go, I don't know if you knew this, Ward, but we have a painter in our midst.
Well, that's a big word, and I thank you for that. But
cool.
I love to do it. It's my therapy, and I went today to buy some supplies.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Cool.
She's tremendous. Do you use oil?
You like it?
I do.
Oh, thank you.
I do.
Oh, that's good.
Your colors are just fabulous.
Well, how did you? Is there a website, or how did you know that?
Yeah, there's a website.
Oh,
there
I'll have
few.
To check it out. I missed that. Oh, now you know what I'm going to do when I get home. Check out all
I
tomorrow.
Do my homework. I do my homework. You use latex or you use oil?
I use acrylics and sometimes oils. But when you travel, you have to do acrylics. They dry out fast.
Yes, and oil is really hard to clean
yes,
up.
Yes, exactly. That's true to clean up.
It's just so difficult.
But I love all the craft, and I'm also learning how to renew old furniture. So I'm crazy about it. But it's another side of me that I want to explore, because it's down to earth. So you don't have big responsibilities in your profession. You have big expectations. You want from you the best at the top, and you grew up in this way. So I needed to find something which is artistic in the same way, in different way, and I don't have so much expectation. So I'm free. But free, it's a very relative word, because then you start demanding from you as well.
Oh, yeah.
Say, I could do better this, and then you start again.
Well, I want to thank you very much for coming in and spending
pleasure.
Time with us. And yes, you must look up Ingrid's paintings. They're fantastic.
I will.
They're really awesome. Our guests today have been Ingrid Fleeter and, of course, Ward Stair, the RPO music director. I'm Julia Figueres. And if you would like more information about the Rochester Philharmonic Orchestra season, you can go to rpo.org. This podcast is a production of WXXI Public Broadcasting.